is better that Denmark's relations with Germany should suffer than that her relations with Jesus Christ should suffer. So said Kai Munk, a Danish pastor and playwright. In 1944, the Nazis shot him through the head and tossed him in a ditch, punishing him for his outspoken resistance to the German occupation of Denmark. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Germany occupied Denmark on April 9, 1940, and did not withdraw until surrendering to the Allies on May 5, 1945. What was life like in Denmark under German occupation? Our guest was there and calls that period the Five Damned Years. Joining us to talk about the German occupation of Denmark is Sir Niels Ingwersen, UW Professor Emeritus of Scandinavian Studies, who was made a knight by the Danish government in recognition of his work on Hans Christian Andersen and other Danish writers.
Welcome back to University of the Air. It's been a long time since we talked Hans Christian Andersen and another thing or two.
It has, and it's very pleasant to be back.
Not so pleasant during those five damned years, though. What was your experience?
Well, you know, kids are so resilient. So many sweet memories of my childhood, playing down in the yard with the other kids, picnicking with my mom and dad, going to our summer house and whatnot. But of course, one thing I did realize, even though I was very young, is that my parents were nervous. My parents were often frightened. What if we have the invasion of Denmark? What if the bombs start falling and so on? They were difficult years. Although we did not suffer in the same way as, say, Belgium, Holland, Norway and Germany. We never had an invasion. The peace came in a rather pleasant fashion. But for my parents, it was very, very difficult to wait for the Allied to come. What will really happen?
And what about your title, The Five Damned Years?
Well, it comes from a song that was made in 1945. Looking back, the years were damned because the Danes and the Norwegians felt they were no longer in charge of their own country.
Certainly true.
Certainly true. And everybody was told, so to speak, what to believe and what to do. Although when the Nazi invasion first happened, we were led to believe that they came as our liberators. Denmark and England had a rather nasty history together. The English came to Copenhagen in 1802 and bombarded Copenhagen and took the Danish fleet away, which was never forgiven, of course. And that was still a part of sort of Danish, or should we say, folklore. So the Germans pretended to be our liberators, and a few believed them. Most did not.
Liberating Denmark from what, though, in 1940?
Well, if we don't come here and liberate you, then the Allies, the English, will occupy you.
Well, in a sense, that's fair because the Allies did, in fact, occupy Iceland.
Yes, they did.
Without asking permission, they just pretty much showed up. Here we are.
That is precisely true. And the Germans feared there would be an Allied invasion in both Denmark and Norway and built a fortress from Northcap to the border between Denmark and Germany. You can still see the remnants of this fortress when you visit the west coast of Denmark and Norway.
Before the German occupation, before the invasion, tell us about Denmark. I mean, what kind of government did it have? What sort of situation was there at that point?
We had a social democratic regime, basically a socialist government, that instituted the welfare state. And the Danish government definitely wanted to stay neutral, like we've been during the First World War, and was accommodating Germany in many, many ways. In a sense, they were collaborating. You could not insult Herr Hitler. He had, after all, that fantastic army, that German juggernaut, which you could not stand up against. There was a lot of talk about what will happen, what will happen. And many people said, I think, the Second World War, ominous, First World War, Second World War, starting counting, the Second World War is bound to come. And as a matter of fact, I remember when that happened. You know, people often ask you, what is your first memory? No one ever knows. But this is one of my first memories. We were in our summer cabin by the sea, and it was in the late September evening, a very pleasant evening. I was playing in the yard, but I realized that the grown-ups were upset, agitated, talking to each other eagerly. So I asked my mom or dad, what is going on? And my mom or dad said, the Second World War has just started.
Hitler invading Poland?
Yeah.
September 1st, 1939.
Sure. And we thought now, well, our turn is coming very soon. It took about a year before our turn came. It was the 9th of April, 1940. My dad has left for work. I was playing in the living room. And suddenly my mom and I heard the sound of airplanes coming closer, 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 closer. We lived in a tall house, 5 stories high, in the outskirts of town. And we could see the airplanes. We could even see the faces of the pilots. And that was the Nazi invasion of Denmark and Norway, 9th of April, 1940.
Quite effective, too. I mean, in both cases, in Norway, they still show places where this is where the church was in Kristiansund, and the gun emplacements are still there.
There's still an awful lot of folklore going around about what happened. Some of it is very true, of course, and some of it is made up later on, because you have to create a myth of resistance and whatnot. There was some fighting, we realized, by the border. The Danish army was trying to keep the German troops back. And I think that fighting lasted for about 2 or 3 hours. Then the Danes gave up. There was some fighting in Copenhagen with the Royal Castle. The King's Guards were protecting the king, and that lasted for a few hours too. And then Denmark surrendered.
And how much destruction was there then?
Not that much. Not that much.
And how do you surrender? I mean, what exactly happened to make it clear that there had been a surrender?
I think that a telegram was sent from the Danish Army Command to the German Army Command. And the Danish soldiers then put down their guns.
In the case of the Norwegians, they managed to sneak their king and much of the treasury out of the country
and form
a government in exile in England, but not so for the Danes?
No, because the king wanted to stay in Copenhagen. He thought it was important that he remained there to give the Danes a symbol of power. I am still in charge here. So that's what the king more or less said. And every day he rode his white horse through the streets of Copenhagen, wearing a Danish officer's uniform. I mean, it's a symbolic action. This is passive resistance. I am still in charge here. And there's only pictures of ordinary citizens walking up to the king, wanting to shake his hand. And he shook their hand.
Did he give radio addresses indicating what the Danish response to the
There
German
were some short radio addresses, and the point was, I mean, keep the peace. Keep the peace. We don't want any ruckus in the streets. And that was also the message of the government, the Danish government. So the situations in Denmark and Norway were very, very different, because in Norway the king fled up north, then to the west, and then he sailed across to England. Now, probably should swap geography here. Denmark is small and flat.
And right next to Germany.
Yes. And Denmark is small. You can put Denmark 3 times into Wisconsin if you like. The same kind of landscape. Hills, but flat. In Norway, you have those mountains.
Fjords.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you can hide in those mountains. And then come back, you know, and attack a German command or something like this. And that's probably the reason why the occupation history is so different from Norway and for Denmark.
And from the German point of view, what was their main interest in Denmark?
Well, Denmark is very good agricultural land. And you need to send foodstuff to the front. And also you want to keep the English out. You want to have that line of defense against the Allied forces.
From the top of Norway all the way down.
All the way down,
through
yes.
France.
Yes. And the interest in Norway was also, I think there was a German myth going on that these Aryan countries really want to side with us. After all, we're so blonde and blue-eyed, you know.
Any truth to it?
For a small percentage, yes. Because during the 1930s, we had the Depression, and it hit Europe very hard, certainly also Denmark and Norway. And if you looked south, you saw Mussolini and Hitler fighting back against the Depression by arming their countries, by creating these juggernauts. You also looked at Stalin, the Marxists, they were doing more or less the same thing. So there was, what should we say, a Marxist temptation and a fascist temptation. And of course some people caved into that.
It's true in this country too.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But people also looked to America. We had FDR with the New Deal. And many people admired that experiment very, very much. And I think the majority of the Norwegians and the Danes prefer to stay democratic.
And if you had to say something about sort of the Danish character itself, because I know we've talked to you in the past about, for example, about Hans Christian Andersen and a sort of darkness of vision. But also, I mean, if I think of some of those stories, which I know are 19th century stories, so long before this time, but there is also this kind of suspicion of bullies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the fact that Germany and Italy clearly were preparing a war did not sit well with Danes and Norwegians. After all, we are pacifists. We don't like guns. We don't buy guns. When my Scandinavian friends come to this country, they're just flabbergasted. All these guns, you know, floating around. They don't understand why. And, you know, Denmark and Norway had not been involved in the war since the 1860s and stayed neutral during the First World War and certainly won't stay neutral this time around. So up north, there's always been a suspicion of those strong nations, England, Germany, and Russia. We want to keep our peaceful Scandinavia. There's no doubt about that.
Let me ask you a slightly irrelevant question, but the Swedes actually did manage to remain at least ostensibly neutral. What was the difference?
Well, they had a strong army. And at that point, you know, there was a pact between Stalin and Hitler. So that part of the world was not a threat to Germany at that point. Also, it is practical to have neutral countries here and there. Switzerland has always been neutral, never invaded. And Sweden plays somewhat the same role here. And some Danes and Norwegians have always, or since then, have been sort of irritated with Sweden for staying neutral.
And selling iron mm-hmm. to the Germans.
Selling iron to the Germans and whatnot. However, the Danes and Norwegians can be so lucky that Sweden was there. That saved the Danish Jews. And many resistance fighters from Norway and Denmark fled to Sweden. So it was good to have that safe haven.
It played its part.
Oh, yeah.
So once the occupation took place then, we're at April 9th, 1940. Mm-hmm. What changes in Denmark then?
Well, Danes are not very strong patriots, really. But suddenly they were. The Danish flag was everywhere, also in usual lapels. People wore paper clips in the lapels as a sign of resistance. And the king became extremely popular, as I mentioned. And the king had no actual power, but he had a very strong symbolic power, and that was very important to the Danes. And then Danes don't much like to be form groups and sing songs, but suddenly that happened. Groups got together and started singing patriotic songs. Actually, I read the other day that in a park in Copenhagen, 40,000 people got together to sing these beautiful Danish songs. One song was about the weeds flying across the border and landing in our beautiful soil. Everybody knew what that meant.
A little bit symbolic there, yes.
That song was, of course, then forbidden.
And what other rules were imposed besides, you said that like a song might be forbidden. How would you sort of notice in daily life that there even was a change?
Well, you would hear the sirens. Now the British are coming up in the air. Everybody has to go indoors and go into the basements. When you go to school, you know, you suddenly hear the sirens out in the hallways. So, and that happened nearly every day and every night.
But let's say in the schools, did anything have to be taught differently, or was there any attempt to change the sort of basic functioning of Danish life?
Not yet. It happened later on, but not in the beginning. Beginning, you know, the changes were more or less minimal. One thing you saw every day was the German troops marching through the streets, singing Wir fahren gegen England. And songs like that, or the Horst Wessel song. And that was very impressive. They marched very well, these young men in green uniforms and so on. And they were very polite, very friendly towards the Danes. They really tried to behave, be on the best behavior. They were ordered to do so. Because Hitler intended Denmark to be sort of the showcase, a window to the other world. See how humanitarian we are. We treat these countries we occupied so well.
Especially if they're blonde hair and blue eyes.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
How much did the Danes know about what was going on in the rest of Europe once the country was taken over?
Here's a major change, of course, because the press, the radio, and the newspapers were censored, quite drastically so. So we realized pretty soon we cannot really trust the news we get that way. You could listen to Sweden, but they were sort of cooperating with the Germans.
BBC?
BBC, precisely. And that was forbidden, by the way. But when you walked through the streets at night, you could hear this signal from BBC all the time. Everybody listened, of course. And a lot of Danes had escaped, or not a lot, but a few, and they formed the Danish government on exile, and you had a Danish press corps, and they broadcast every night. So we heard about what was going on in the world, but in the beginning, the Germans were winning, you know. It was very, very depressing to listen to these newscasts from BBC.
Yeah, so until 1942, at least.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
the
yeah.
invasion of North
so
Africa.
So we heard about, you know, the English being kicked out of France. We heard about France falling and so on, and all that. And we also heard eventually about the invasion of Russia. So we got the news that way. And then eventually, every day, you found in your mailbox a little mimeograph sheet, sort of a little newsletter from the resistance movement. And they also tried to tell you what really was happening.
That sounds dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was dangerous also for the kids who did that, put the newspapers in the mailboxes. Sure.
For everybody.
But, you know, now slowly, slowly, a resistance was beginning to be formed. And that's part of it, you know, trying to tell you what really was happening in the world.
More on the resistance movement when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
In winter lang og mørk og hård, på fem forbandede år, har snuet landet i sin favn, med kulde, sult og savn. Og der gik slid på skoven, skår på skår, og der gik rådenskab i svage træer. Gå til modstand, alle danske, alle mand som en, og gør Danmark frit.
That's a Danish resistance song about the five damned years of the German occupation. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland and our guest, Sir Niels Ingwersen. We were just talking about the start of the resistance movement in Denmark under German occupation, and you were there as a child. I'm curious how your life as a child or the lives of those around you changed, again, in terms of starting to notice the change in daily life.
Well, for one thing, every night we pulled black curtains down so that the English airplanes wouldn't see a city. And we had to do that for 5 years. And actually, when I enter a classroom at this university in which a movie has been shown, the curtains are often down. I always pull them up because those black curtains, for me, is a symbol of war. I can't stand them. The sirens every night. And soon the schools became barracks, also for refugees. And so my education was very reduced. It was often 2 hours every day, and then later on, 2 hours every other day. So it was 3 hours only. Also, shopping for groceries became a problem. You realized that you could not buy butter today. There were no cigarettes, for sure. No chocolate. Now and then, not even bread. And the government issued rationing stamps. So when you bought a pound of butter, you have to hand over a stamp. And often towards the end of these 3 months, you know, there were no more stamps left. You could feel that. Coffee. You couldn't get coffee. So you started making Danish coffee out of wheat and barley. And I was told later on that when you really got coffee again in 46, my mom was so happy. And she said, now you're going to have real coffee. I couldn't stand it. I was used to the Danish stuff. My parents talked about Lucky Strikes and Chesterfields and Camels. You couldn't get them. You got Danish cigarettes instead. You couldn't get sugar and you couldn't get chocolate. And then you couldn't get gasoline. So the cars were put away. People started biking again. Or they started using horses. One sound of my childhood is clip, clop, clip, clop, clip, clop in the streets. And then you could bike, of course, but then you couldn't get the rubber, couldn't get tires. So people took ropes and put around the bike tires. Not a very good solution. So there was this everyday impact. My dad was a truck driver. He carried around oxygen containers. So he was allowed gasoline for a while, but then he couldn't have that either. So they built some stoves on the back of the trucks and fed these stoves a piece of wood. And you could drive for that about an hour. Not healthy, it wasn't, but that's the way you get around.
Wood-burning cars.
Yes, wood-burning cars. Amazing. You could use that now.
Yeah.
Now, all this gave rise to a tremendous black market. It would, of course. And if you had friends or family out in the countryside, you visited them so often to get eggs, you know, and meat and whatnot. I have a story here. Now and then, you couldn't heat your home because there was no coal in the garden. We burned peat. I can still remember the smell of peat. But now and then, there was nothing. My dad came home with two bricks he put into waste oil. You could light those. There was a flame at least, not much heat. One day he came home very, very happy because he'd bought on the black market, of course, a big sack of coal, wonderful black coal. It was a very cold day. He put it in the shed down in the yard and said, we're going to burn these coals and really, really get cold. Then there was a thaw. And then it got cold again. And I was sent down by my ma to get that sack of coal. What I found was a big lump of ice. My dad had bought colored ice instead of coal.
He'd been gypped.
Scammed, exactly. Typical story from the occupation.
What did the Danes think of the English at this point? Here the English were bombing Denmark, doing considerable amount of damage, ostensibly to liberate Denmark, which had already been liberated by the Germans. It got a little confusing, didn't it?
The English were very laid back about bombing Denmark. There were a few bombardments. The French school in Copenhagen was bombed by mistake. But the English always admitted we didn't want to do this. It was a bad, bad mistake. They apologized. And since we listened to BBC every night, and since the resentment of the Nazis was growing, there was a lot of sympathy for the Brits, a growing sympathy for the Brits and for the Americans after Pearl Harbor.
What made the resentment of the Nazis grow? I mean, here you said the soldiers were polite, the country was orderly, though rationing.
The resistance was growing. In the beginning, it was just spontaneous. But it got organized fairly soon and pretty well organized. And the main aim of the resistance was to prevent those wonderful Danish goodies to go to the front. So they blew up the railroads. And, of course, the Germans wanted to prevent that, so you had gun battles. And also some factories or shipyards that were working for the Germans, they had to, they were forced to, were also blown up. I can remember hearing, you know, gunfire at night and the sound of distance explosions. And every night you had the hum of the English and American planes coming across. And they came very low, because they were dropping guns and ammunition for the resistance. So resistance was growing. And somehow Denmark or Norway both became more and more polarized. And there was more and more sympathy for the Allies and less sympathy for the Nazis.
Jews in Denmark?
There were Jews in Denmark, quite a sizable population, actually, and also in Norway.
And what was their fate?
Well, as I said before, Hitler wanted Denmark to be the showcase, so no one had to wear the Star of David. But, of course, well, the Jewish population is so international, so cosmopolitan. So they realized that our cousins in Germany, Holland, you know, are disappearing. So they were scared. And eventually in 1943, it was decided by some high command, I think in Denmark, von Hanneken, that we should also intern the Danish Jews and send them to Germany. Now what happened here is ambiguous. That somebody from the German High Command apparently leaked word to a German who was working there, who had lived in Denmark for 3-4 years in the 30s and liked the Danes and had good Danish connections. And this one person apparently sneaked out. And now the word was leaked. You better hide because soon you'll be arrested. Beginning of October of 43. It seemed that the Danes are ready to handle the problem. A lot of fishing boats took the Jews across the narrow sound that connects Denmark and Sweden. I think about 95% of the Danish Jews managed to escape. In Norway, it was exactly the opposite. Also, some small Jewish children, you know, who might cry, you know, on the fishing boat, you can hear that, were sent out to the countryside to the farmers, and they pretended to be Danish kids the rest of the occupation.
Why do you think it is that Denmark managed to, I guess, protect most of its Jews?
I think that the ordinary Danes wanted to help out. For a while, the Jews, they left their apartments in Copenhagen. They mainly lived in Copenhagen and stayed with friends who were Danes. And then these Danes contacted the fishermen up along the coast, And they then decided on that night, you come by and we try to get you across. And a lot of Danish Nazis were bribed to look the other way. The Danes felt that, you know, those people who had joined the Nazi party and had donned German uniforms are not very bright, and they're corrupt. And actually, they seem to be right.
Did they make a distinction? Did the Danes make a distinction then about various kinds of Germans
yes.
in uniform?
They did. Some did not, but some did. I mean, these young men in green uniforms didn't want to be in Denmark. They wanted to be with their family or their sweethearts, wives in Germany. They were sad and lonely. That's very clear. But it was difficult to befriend them because then you play footsie with the enemy. But it happened. And some young German soldiers and Danish girls got together, and there's a sad story about that I can tell you later. Those that the Danes really disliked were those in black uniforms, SS, Gestapo, and then the Danish Schalburg Corps, that Danish Nazis that wanted to fight on the Eastern Front, the Reds. I have a couple of stories here that are sort of touching, I think. There's an island in southern Denmark called Strynø. It's a small island, 200 people, and one village and some farms. And it was too small for Germans to bother with. There was no occupation there. So one German soldier took off his clothes and swam across to the island and told the farmers why he was there. And they said, fine, put on some Danish clothes and work in the fields. He stayed the rest of the occupation and married eventually a Danish girl. That is a good story. Then I have one that's sort of sad, I think. My dad drove a truck, as I told you, and he'd been down with some oxygen containers to a factory south, close to the border of the German border. He was driving north again, and there were two German soldiers in green uniforms hitchhiking. They're not supposed to do that. So he stopped, and he spoke a bit of German, so he got their story. They said, we are tired of this war. We don't want to fight. We want to go to Sweden, like some other people do. And my dad said, absolutely impossible. You have to cross a bridge, and there is the Gestapo, and cross two waters, two sounds to get to Sweden. You'll be caught. We want to try, said the German soldiers. And he said, all right, I'll drive you to the next city. And I can't drive you through the city because I'll be stopped at least twice by the Gestapo. I'll drive around the city, and I'll wait on the other side for an hour. But I can't wait any longer because there's curfew. I have to be back by 7 o'clock. They said, fine. So they said goodbye to him, and he drove across the town, and waited on the other side. He waited for an hour, and they all saw them again. So who knows
yes.
what happened.
Yeah. Many stories like that in a confusing situation like war. What about the resistance? How effective was it, and how did the Germans deal with it?
It seemed pretty effective. If you showed you a map of Denmark with a little cross for every railroad blown up, you know, Denmark would be completely filled. So it was effective in that sense, although some people said it was not. A number of factories were blown up, and the Germans fought back, which seems to indicate that it was effective. A number of Danes were arrested, and especially the Danish collaborators tortured these Danes. They wanted more names, more information. And some of these Danes who were apparently executed because they shot some Germans. So the situation was getting more and more tense. And every day, even the Danish newspapers were filled with incidents. The Danes and Norwegians took a particular dislike to the informers, the Danes who informed the Nazis about the resistance. I mean, a typical scene is this. This Danish Nazi realizes that there's something going on in the neighbor's house because people are coming late, sneaking into the basement. So he realizes very likely a resistance group. The next day he calls the Gestapo and tells them, and these people are arrested and possibly tortured, and some might be executed.
And would you say that the reason for that Danish informant for doing that is actually sympathy with the Nazis, with fascism, anti-Semitism, self-interest? What would you say the motivation would have been?
There's been studies of that. There are so many reasons. Some people were simply so seduced by Herr Hitler. This is the right ideology, and it's bound to conquer the world, so he has to be on that side. Some were weak souls. cowards, people who could be bribed, corrupt people, whatnot. Many of those in uniform were not very smart. I could not be a Danish soldier, but the Germans accept me. I have a beautiful black uniform now. See who I am.
Oh, so instant power.
Instant power, exactly, yeah. There's so many motivations there. Also, I sided with the Nazis. Now they're losing. But, you know, I can't change now. Desperation.
You have to protect yourself.
Yes, exactly.
And were there centers of the resistance the way, for example, in this country with the civil rights movement, there were often churches that were functioning as kind of the main centers?
Churches, farms out in the countryside away from the Nazis, some taverns, big places where natural to have guests. Yeah, those centers. We didn't know about them until after the war, of course. And Copenhagen, so many basements, Copenhagen. All the Jewish treasures from the synagogue was hidden in a Christian church next door during the war. There are so many stories.
And were there organizers or key figures
there
or heroes?
There were organizers. There was a resistance command, very prominent Danes, a number of the ministers, by the way. And they gave orders, and they discussed the matters with the people in England, and even with the Brits and the Americans.
How did they communicate?
Well, by code. For instance, when you listen to BBC every night, after the news, we heard, well, you know, the cucumber would like to talk to the strawberries. And the potatoes had taken an intense dislike to the leeks. Here we have codes. Blow up that railroad, that shipyard and whatnot. Morse code, in code. There were many ways of communicating.
In the Resistance Museum in Oslo, there's quite a display of very ingenious ways of smuggling data. And sometimes in very small bits.
Oh, yeah.
That in some cases must have taken a lot of ingenuity and a lot of time and a certain amount of risk.
Sure. I mean, a lot of information was smuggled to Sweden. From Sweden, then it went to England. That was fairly easy. And Denmark is so close to Sweden that it was fairly easy to do that.
Did you in your own life, Niels, there in Denmark, notice people being punished for resisting?
I never saw liquidation. I'm lucky. But it happened in my hometown. I saw more of the punishment afterwards, where the Danish girls who had children, babies with German soldiers, were shaved. Not pleasant. The death penalty was introduced. Not pleasant either. And there were bad things about the aftermath. There was some sense of revenge in there.
And what about others, like teachers or people you knew that might have participated in resistance?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of my teachers here in inter-school and in high school were arrested and interned in concentration camps. And it's typical they don't want to talk about it. It was they were brutalized. They saw things that you don't want to talk about. Other people being terrorized and whatnot. So most people kept mum. And a very sad thing about the resistance was that when you resist, life has meaning and purpose. You're fighting evil. You can shoot, although you're a pacifist, you can shoot that person because he's a Nazi. Then comes the peace, and ambiguity returns. War and jihading back to normalcy is very hard. And I knew some people afterwards, knew some people in a group, and a number of those people committed suicide. They simply couldn't take everyday life afterwards.
That's some fairly common occurrence.
Primo Levi, I mean,
when you've gone through such a ringer that has tested not only your ability to survive, but the extent to which you're willing to sacrifice others for your survival.
Yeah.
It seems that that depression and the suicidal tendency
also follow often. I survived that concentration camp. My friends did not.
Survivor guilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, precisely. Primo Levi.
We'll look further at the phenomenon of Denmark under the Nazi occupation, 5 years of it, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Sir Niels Ingvarsson. We're talking about the Nazi occupation of Denmark, 1940 to 1945. Five damned years, as it's referred to in Denmark. In terms of reacting to the way the Germans were occupying the country, what kind of a position were the writers in Denmark put into? How did they use their skills in this situation?
It's always interesting to see how artists react to occupation. But also, well, when you have an occupation, you also have insurgency. We know that. Also within the arts. Kai Munk's name was mentioned earlier. He was a Danish dramatist and minister, and very prominent. And maybe his fate is a bit typical, because in the 30s, early 30s, he admired Hitler. He saw the strong man, you know, putting his country back on the map again. And he wrote about that. But then he traveled through Germany and realized what was happening. So he changed completely. And from the pulpit, spoke up against the occupation. And then one day he came to church on Sunday, not dressed in the clerical garb, but in ordinary coat, did not walk up to the pulpit, but stood below it, and preached against the Germans, against the Nazis. And a few days later, he was shot. The Germans could not allow this kind of open resistance, especially not when the man was very well known. I do remember the fact that Munk was shot. I was about 7 years old.
I would think the Germans might worry that he'd turn into a martyr.
And he did. It was a Danish group that did this, and it was a stupid thing to do. The Germans realized that afterwards. A number of Danish authors joined the resistance by writing anonymously for the illegal magazines. And I want to mention one author about whom my wife and I have written a book, Martin A. Hansen. Hansen was a very well-known writer. And one day, two people ring his doorbell. And they ask him whether they come in and talk to him in privacy. And of course he said yes. And then they said, we are two of the leaders of the resistance, and we need your assistance, your help. You see, we have to execute these traitors, these informers who tell Gestapo about the Danish resistance. We cannot wait. We cannot have a court case. We cannot have a verdict. These people have to be executed on the street here and now. And that's very hard for our young people to do. They can engage in gun battle when they are sabotage with the Germans. But to shoot a man down, so to speak, in cold blood in the streets, that's very, very hard for young pacifists. So will you write something about the necessity that is imperative to liquidate these informers? And Hansen said yes. So he started writing. And eventually he had to flee to Sweden because people realized this is Martin Hansen's style. We know who the author is. And he got away.
How is this being disseminated, by the way?
By illegal publications, mimeographing.
And just then they slipped and you found in the mailbox again, that kind of thing.
In the mailbox every day. And also some were read over BBC, I think, and from Sweden. Then he came back after 45 and he was told by various people, your articles really had an impact. People joined the resistance because you wrote that, and some of the people who joined for that reason have been killed. Here you have the might of the pen, so to speak. And Hansen never forgot that. It haunted him forever after.
And so he did write about the need to shoot someone down?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He could do it in his fiction, sort of in the subtext, but this was in the real text. The necessity of killing, executing these informers, yes.
On the other hand, well, the road not taken would have been not to do so, and whether more suffering would have ensued because of not protecting the resistance.
Yes, exactly, and that's why the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard became so important during these years. It's either or. You have to make a choice.
And were the Germans looking very closely at what was being written in Danish?
I would say that the Danish collaborators were those who were the censors, were those who were looking for hidden clues and whatnot. Because they realized, it's like the Gestapo that realized Germany is losing was still deporting Jews to concentration camps. The same thing is going on here. You know, we are desperate, we are losing, but we still have some power. They exercise that power. Desperation is the word we need here for the last year of the occupation, I think.
What were the turning points then in terms of the war that were milestones for the resistance?
Well, we heard about, you know, Stalingrad. We heard about the invasion of Africa, of Italy, then Normandy,
D-Day. By the Allies.
Yes. So gradually, in 43, it was very clear what way the wind was blowing. Absolutely. And the Germans knew that too. And by the way, now the Germans look different. They were no longer the strapping young boys. They were old men, boys 14, 15. They didn't want to be in Denmark. And my dad asked one of the guards standing outside the factory, what are you going to do when the Americans come? And he said, well, I have a white handkerchief here. I'm going to wave that. Again, there are a lot of stories like that. So we knew that sort of we were heading for the ending. And we knew that the Americans and the English might invade Denmark. And although there were no pictures at this point, we realized, you know, how bloody that destructive that battle could be. And I have here a little booklet issued by the War Department in Washington, D.C., to be given to the American soldiers heading north from Normandy. It's a pocket guide to the cities of Denmark. And only military personnel has right to read this. The first paragraph goes like this. Attention. About the only thing in this booklet that can be guaranteed is the terrain. The rest of it is up to the fortunes or misfortunes of war. Many of the towns and cities described here have been bombed and shelled by us as we approached, and shelled by the enemy as he retreats. And many of them will still show the marks of destruction visited upon them when the lands been conquered and occupied by the Germans. So you can hear that fear in the air.
So here's a guide to the cities of Denmark, but we don't know which ones are still standing.
Precisely.
Well, compared to the situation in much of France, of course, that became a fierce battleground in the months after D-Day, Belgium, Holland, certainly, sure, and Germany itself, what was the Allied push so far as Denmark was concerned? Did it become a front?
If the Germans had been stubborn, it could easily have happened. But luckily, that was not to be. I mean, in 1947, I was a Boy Scout, and we were finally allowed to see Europe. And my Boy Scout troop went to Belgium and Holland. We drove through Germany. We were not allowed to stop, but we saw Hamburg and Bremen, and they were completely devastated, just heaps of ruins. That could easily have happened in Denmark, but it didn't.
The Germans surrendered before...
The Germans surrendered before, and there was... Here, late in April 45 and early May, there were so many signs. And one sign was that Red Cross came into the picture with great force. And they were now trying to evacuate the prisoners in the war camps in northern Germany to Denmark and Norway to save them from the destruction of war. These were mainly officers, British and American officers, who were dealt with in a very fairly decent way by the Germans. So my father's truck was confiscated by the Red Cross, painted white with the Red Cross on it. And he and some other truck drivers were sent to the border to pick up materials for these camps, tents, I think. And that was late April 29th, I think, and I thought it was very exciting that my dad was going to go on this trip. So I said, can I come along? Mm-hmm. My mom said, absolutely not. But apparently I was quite convincing. So I was allowed to come along. I remember this drive through the night in convoy, these white trucks all the way down to the border. Very, very, very exciting. And we stayed in some barracks during that night. And we'd hear the bombs fall in the distance in Germany. Then the next day we got the tents and drove back to a manor house close to my hometown where we unloaded tents. And my father's truck and the other trucks drove into this courtyard, which was filled with about 200, 250 American and English soldiers. And, of course, these soldiers, these officers, had not seen a little child, a little boy for 3-4 years. So they came up to the truck and stood in a big ring around this. And they wanted to touch, wanted to give me things. I didn't understand a word they were saying, but just to see a child again, which meant so, so much to them. I mean, it's amazing. It was amazingly touching. I didn't understand it then, but now I do.
Were these the first Americans you had seen?
Yeah. They were, actually. I haven't thought about that. You're absolutely right.
And what was the king doing this whole time? Is he just waiting and still riding on his horse and wearing his uniform?
Well, the king was riding his white horse on the uniform. And now what you get now might be history, it might be folklore. He was so important as a symbol, as I said before, that one day the beautiful horse reared up and threw the king to the ground. And the story is that some Danish Nazi sympathizer had blown one of these whistles that people cannot hear, but the horse can. Who knows what the truth is? He will never, never know. He was an old man. It was a hard fall. So he was ill, I would say, the rest of his life. He died in 47. But still, you know, pictures of him went up everywhere. Pictures of the queen and the three small princesses. I mean, you fight back with...
with what you have.
Yeah, what you have.
As the war came to a close, did reprisals against Germans' resistance increase?
Well, this I remember. Listening to the Hitlerpolizei, the Danish Gestapo, run through the streets at night, they were scared to walk slowly because the resistance might get them. So they ran through the streets in desperation towards a place they felt safe. So there were reprisals, yes. And... there were more and more shootouts, more and more executions, and the Germans fought back with the clearing. The Tivoli Gardens in Copenhagen were blown up, for instance. Sort of beloved Danish places were destroyed. So the scene was becoming very, very, very hectic.
And how did you experience the end of all this?
Well, every night we went down to my grandma's place. She was bedridden, had been so for 20 years. It was very important that we were there together when we listened to BBC. Sort of a ritual within the family. And then talk about the news afterwards, the good news, so to speak. And we were listening to the usual news, and they were very encouraging because the Allies had made great progress in Germany, and France was liberated. And the Russians were moving towards Berlin. And then came the usual codes, you know, from England to resistance. And then the announcer was about to sign off when his voice broke. And he said, "I had just been informed that the German troops in Holland, northern Germany, and Denmark have surrendered." And then everybody went out on the street, laughing, crying, hugging, kissing, dancing, shouting. And there were no Germans in sight. They were hiding. And everywhere you saw the American flag, the British flag, Union Jack, the Soviet flag, the French flag, and the sign of ARF, you know, Royal Air Force. And the church bells started ringing, 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 and were ringing for the next 48 hours. That was a wonderful, euphoric moment. And for a short period, it was thought, now the last war for democracy has been fought. The demon has been slain, Hitler. Now we live together peacefully. So it's a moment you do not forget. I was 9 years old. I will never forget it.
You've talked a little bit about the aftermath in terms of Danish women having their head shaved. Yeah. And when did that sort of euphoria turn to sort of something else?
And legal proceedings.
Oh, yeah. It happened right away. I remember going to school 2 days, 3 days later. We had some days off, of course. And a schoolmate of mine had sort of been prominent because he had money, more money than the rest of us. He had a fantastic sled. We 8 people on it and whatnot, and fancy clothes and whatnot. He had all that stuff because his father was a collaborator. So daddy was arrested, and this boy sat and cried all day in school. So that you remember. I remember seeing people with the armband, red, white, and blue, resistance fighters going from house to house and arresting people. And the Germans were taken to camps outside of town. Also remember the people in the schools now were no longer German soldiers, but refugees who had fled the Russian army, the Soviet army. They're coming up to Denmark now. They looked awful, poor and destitute.
Yeah, the Eastern Front was notorious for being as bad as it got.
Oh, terrible. Those were the people who came to Denmark. And they were happy being there, poor souls, poor souls. The members of the Hilfepolizei were certainly arrested. And very soon the court cases started. And Denmark did not have capital punishment, but it was thought that the crimes of these people, informers and Hilfepolizei, who had shot, tortured and shot resistance people, were so grave that we ought to do the same to them. So the death penalty was reintroduced for a very short period. The poor women who had gone out with the German soldiers were arrested and sort of put on trucks and paraded through the streets with their bald heads, shaved heads. Not a pretty sight either. You know, something always goes wrong and besmirches a beautiful moment. Then in August, the news came of the first atom bomb, Hiroshima. That not so pretty either. And then the pictures came from the Holocaust. We had known the concentration camps. Oh, yes. We had known the Jews in concentration camps. We knew there was torture and whatnot and death. But when those pictures came of those naked, starved bodies, piles of them, we did not know that. That was really a fantastic, sad awakening to what humanity can do to humanity.
How did that whole five-year experience, do you think, affect generally Danish thinking? I mean, what changed between 1939 and 1945?
Well, we always talk about, I mean, all cultures talk about the loss of innocence. And we have not been in war since the 1860s. It can't happen here. That's a common thought. And it did happen here. So I think that the Danes and the Norwegians felt they were moving into the modern, ambiguous world. Earlier you felt you know more or less what to expect. And now, what's going to happen? And you know, towards the end of 45, people were starting counting again. First World War, Second World War, Third World War. I mean, the Cold War came and had a profound impact on all of us somehow. Communism, Marxism, seemed like another possibility. And it took a few years before communism became the god that failed. That was Hungary, the uprising in Hungary, and, you know, the occupation of, and so on.
Czechoslovakia. Sir Niels Ingvarsson, it's been a pleasure having you with us again for this hour, this time, talking about the 5 years of occupied Denmark.
It has certainly been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
The five damned years have been a pleasure for us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year. At the time of the American Revolution, the Founding Fathers had an opportunity to abolish slavery before the new country began. What happened to that opportunity? We'll find out with guest John Kaminsky next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air here on Wisconsin Public Radio.